I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. As lifelong Disney fans, the work of countless talented Disney creatives have shaped our lives.
Now, as the Disney catalog expands, we're taking a journey through film and television to discover if that spark that shaped us as children lives on in adulthood.
Does your favorite Disney media still cast that same spell? Join us as we find out. We are
Rewatching the Magic. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
Let's kind of preface this episode right now. Both of us are kind of recovering from illness at the moment. So if we both sound like crap, we apologize. But we really wanted to get an episode out this week.
Yeah. Apologize for sounding like a cheese grater has attacked my throat. But nothing to be done about that. I sound much better than I did yesterday.
How did we both get sick and we're like hundreds of miles apart? How did that happen?
I don't know. I think it's just going around the entire nation right now.
Yeah. So again, apologies for sounding like butt. All right. So this week's movie is a movie that we had wanted to talk about for a while. Night at the Museum. We have not touched this franchise yet, the Ben Stiller series about a night watchman taking over a museum where the exhibits come to life at night. I did not know this before researching this movie. This was based off a kid's book. It's very little kid's book. It's a picture book. Same thing. The night watchman goes to sleep during his rounds and wakes up to find that the dinosaurs in the museum have come to life. And they've greatly expanded that in this movie. So it's not just the dinosaurs that come to life. It's the entire museum. I was not really interested in this movie when it first came out, but a lot of people... this was 2006, it's 2024, there's an entire generation that this movie was their childhood, so that I can understand.
Yeah, I'm gonna say the same. You know, this was aimed more at children, and I was a whole grown-ass adult when this movie came out. When I saw it, I was like, I'll catch it later as a rental. And then I just never did. So while I had seen clips of it, this was kind of a first watch for me as far as sitting all the way through.
Same. I had seen parts of this movie. It's one of those movies you see for the tail end of it, flipping through channels kind of movie. But as for sitting down, beginning to end, watching this is a first for me.
And this has an absolutely stellar cast. Ben Stiller and Owen Wilson to the side. Ricky Gervais, I don't know what you're doing in here. But everybody else, absolutely just all-star cast.
Robin Williams?
Yeah, Robin Williams alone, need you say more.
Three legends of the silver screen: Mickey Rooney, Dick Van Dyke, and Bill Cobbs.
Yeah, as the aging night watchmen who are passing the torch to Ben Stiller. And then, you've got all these other people popping in as the exhibits. Steve Coogan is in this. You got the voice of Brad Garrett. This is Rami Malek's first movie.
Yeah, and see where he's at now.
Yeah. Most of the people kind of in the side, Patrick Gallagher is in here as Attila the Hun. You're like, oh, okay. I didn't expect him in here. He's almost unrecognizable because they've got him under all the mustaches and beards and stuff. But the thing about it is all the acting talent in front of the camera, and then the talent behind the camera, it was written by Thomas Lennon and Robert Ben-Garrett, who you would probably know as Lieutenant Dangle and Deputy Junior if you watch Reno 911. So you're like, all right, we're going to get some comedy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's produced by Chris Columbus.
With a nice little joke in the movie about that.
Yeah. And then it's directed by Sean Levy, who we've talked about before, because he works a lot with Ryan Reynolds.
Yep. Directing the upcoming Deadpool and Wolverine.
Yeah. And we've already talked about Free Guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched The Adam Project that the two of them did for Netflix, and I rather liked that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's a pretty competent director. Everything about this, you're like, on paper, this is really going to work. Alan Silvestri doing the score here.
Legend.
Yep. So, yeah, want to get into what we thought about it?
I mean, I thought it was fine. It's an early 2000s kids movie. I'm not expecting Shakespeare.
Well, here's the thing I'm going to say, and this will probably let you know where I'm starting off here. There is a Mystery Science Theater adage that is, don't remind the audience of a better movie in the middle of your crappy movie. And all I could think of while watching this movie is, damn, I could be watching Hobgoblins right now. And if you're not a Mystery Science Theater viewer, Hobgoblins is a movie that people only know if they've watched Mystery Science Theater. Because it's a movie about a young kid who gets a job as a night watchman at a movie theater in which there is like a secret in the night thing, and then like all heck breaks loose and oh no, what's going on at night in the thing I'm supposed to be guarding? Like, it's basically, I think that these two writers just watched that while stoned, and like they say it's based on a children's book, but it seemed a little more Hobgoblins.
I mean, the idea of thing inanimate objects come to life when no one's looking is nothing new. Toy Story. You know what this movie really reminded me of? The Indian in the Cupboard.
Which I also have never seen.
And I haven't seen that movie since it came out. And short version, Indian in the Cupboard is about this little boy. He has a cupboard. Then when he puts one of his toys in it, it comes to life. And that's all I could think about watching this movie.
Yeah, I'm going to say, like, you've got two really good, comedians writing this movie. And all I could think of was, why didn't they put any jokes in this? Because this is another one where, like, it markets itself as a comedy, and I keep wondering where the jokes are.
The comedy bits is the typical Ben Stiller is awkward.
I do not find Ben Stiller funny, which is really weird because his parents are hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Stiller is a Nepo baby that should have gotten more Nepo. His mother is in this, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It was nice to see her. She has a bit part as the woman who helps him find a job.
Mm.
The late great Anne Meara.
Mm. His father, of course, the legendary Jerry Stiller.
Sir, not appearing in this movie.
Mm.
But the the thing is that there are these kind of awkward jokes about him saying that he feels he has a connection with her at the job placement office. And she keeps going, yeah, no, I don't feel any connection to you. Which is cute if you know that they are mother and son. The joke does not land if you do not know that connection.
It's like when you're casting two actors who are brothers in a movie and they go, hey, you look familiar. Do I know you? Nah, I've never seen you before in your life.
Yeah, but the thing is that they kind of play it up too much. And it's like, I know that connection. I know who Anne Meara is. But even for me, like, it was one of those where you grin slightly and then you're like, okay, move on. Thank you.
I think it's just the character that he plays, Larry, is just trying to butter up the unemployment officer, the clerk at the unemployment office, who she plays, to kind of, hey, you know, we have this connection, we have this thing, give me a good job.
The thing is I understand the joke, but we are dissecting a frog at this point.
Yeah, I get it.
Also, Paul Rudd is in this as the future stepfather.
Playing the opposite role he would in Ant-Man?
Yeah.
Instead of playing the loser who had the divorced wife and kid to a new guy, he is the new father and marrying the divorced mother and taking in the kid.
And this movie desperately needed more Paul Rudd. I think if Paul Rudd were the Ben Stiller part, this movie would have been better.
I'm not going to disagree on that, but that's just Paul Rudd being Paul Rudd.
Yeah, I think this movie would have been so much better if Paul Rudd had it been the Ben Stiller part.
It's weird because it's Ben Stiller playing Ben Stiller, and if you don't find Ben Stiller funny, the character doesn't work. Paul Rudd playing Paul Rudd works regardless.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to dislike Paul Rudd.
You know, I'll throw the joke in there. Paul Rudd doesn't age because he does it. Whatever health, whatever diet he's doing, whatever hair plug he's got put in his head, it's working.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Rudd is that magical Egyptian tablet, just in human form.
Yeah.
I mean, Ben Stiller, you're supposed to root for him. He's the underdog, and you're like, oh, I want you to have your kid, and whatever, but I don't really care. I kind of want the T-Rex to step on him through most of the movie.
Kind of want to till the HUD and rip him in half, right?
Yeah.
I guess we can go into the movie proper. So Ben Stiller plays Larry, a guy who has tried various get-rich-quick schemes, and they've all failed. His claim to fame is he invented a device called the Snapper, which is just basically the clapper, but you snap your fingers, and it never went anywhere because as his mother would say in the movie, clapping is easier than snapping. The fact that it comes off as a BS line in that scene, and then it turns out to be true by the end of the movie, is weird.
Yeah.
Like, it's the way he tells the story, it sounds like he's very much making crap up as he's jawjacking to this unemployment clerk to try to boost up his resume and try to get a better job. But then at the end of the movie, he snaps his fingers and his flashlight turns off. So it was true. If it had just been a joke, that okay, I'm blatantly lying to you to pad out my resume, it might have made the scene a little bit more funnier. Again, depending on whether you find Ben Stiller funny or not. But the point is, he is kind of a loser. He's all of his get rich quick schemes have blown up in his face. And if he doesn't find a steady job soon, he's going to lose visitation rights to his son. His wife is probably going to move out of New York with her new Paul Rudd investment banker husband.
I mean, the only bad part of that is that Paul Rudd is an investment banker of some sort.
Bond
like,
trainer,
give him a better job.
I mean, the point is that they want him to have a white collar job, and I guess bond trader, banker man was the most white collar of white collar jobs they could give him. Like, he is so much more successful than you, Ben Stiller. Why would we? What would I not want to be with very rich, very handsome Paul Rudd? So the only job that the unemployment office has is a opening for a night watchman at the National History Museum, and they send him there, and he doesn't know it's for a night watchman job. He just knows it's for a job. So he
He thinks he's going to be a docent or something.
He tries to butter up the lady docent at the museum with his wrong things on history, thinking, oh, it's good. This is going to be my new job now, blah, blah, blah. But it turns out his job is night watchman. And he meets up with the night crew. Again, we've mentioned him, played by Dick Van Dyke, Mickey Rooney, and Bill Cobbs. They are old. They are retiring, forced retirement by the museum, because the museum feels that the job of three old guys can be done by one young guy. An era where Ben Stiller would be considered a young man.
Yeah.
And they say, well, tonight's your first night. Good luck. Here's a rule book to follow for your first night in the job. Good luck. His first night in the job, he is surprised to find out that the various exhibits come to life. And I will give the movie at this point credit, because this movie does not waste time. All of what I just said is the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
They know this movie is called Night at the Museum, and they waste no time getting you to the museum.
Well, the thing is that I am going to point out that the old the older security guards are kind of stupid. Their manual that they give him, as someone who has written manuals like that before, do better.
It's supposed to be funny.
I know it's supposed to be funny, but once again, I don't know. I kept looking for the this is one of those things. We've talked about it before, where we have movies that we'll watch where you're like, okay, I see where this is the form of a joke, but it doesn't land. Like, I see where this has all the parts of a joke, but it doesn't work. You know?
Mm-hmm. I think you have to be a kid. And we were not kids when this movie came out. Like I said, this, for a lot of people, this was their childhood. So if you're a 20-something-year-old person and this was your childhood, maybe you did find this movie funny.
Yeah, and I know. It just... It was written by adults.
I don't know.
That's the only thing I'm going to say in that response. Mm. But it's like the manual is one of those things that only makes sense in retrospect. Like, the manual is only useful on night two. You know?
Yeah, but if you figure out, I mean, knowing their plan, having a bad manual and purposely giving Larry bad advice is kind of the point.
Yeah.
Especially when, because when you, at the first at the first part of the movie to say, yeah, this is the guy. I know that this is the guy. And going through the movie, you think, okay, they know that he is someone special, that he can handle the job, he can do the thing.
And what they really mean is, this is our Patsy.
Exactly. The entire point of choosing Larry to be the security guard is these three old security guards are angry that they're getting fired. They do not like being forced into retirement, and they are kind of using Larry to ruin, to mess up the museum at night and to cause a ruckus and to get him in trouble. He gets fired twice in this movie. And their plan is to rob the museum right out from under him. Rob the museum so they can have a long and luxurious retirement by stealing these priceless artifacts from the museum and selling them to who knows what.
And let's get to the crux of this. They also want the tablet that brings things to life.
The Tablet of Aknamra.
Because the other thing that it's doing is it's keeping them rather youthful for old men. We see the difference between them when they're away from the tablet and them when they're under the influence of the tablet. And when they're away from the tablet, they have to use, like, canes and stuff like that, and their joints are stiff. And when they're near the tablet, they can, you know, move easier. They have fight sequences, all that kind of stuff.
Dick Van Dyke cracking his neck before he punches Ben Stiller.
I mean, the funny thing about that, though, is that's just Dick Van Dyke. Like, Dick Van Dyke, who at time of recording is still with us. Mm-hmm. Knockwood. Like, Dick Van Dyke is you know, at the time they were making this movie, he was still spry. You can I mean, in the post credit scene.
Yeah,
he's the post credit scene.
He still got the moves.
Well, several years after this, and we mentioned this when we were talking about Mary Poppins in our 100th episode, that he came out and did a version of Step in Time with Derek Hough. And Derek Hough, who choreographed the number, Dick Van Dyke, who was in his late 80s, I think, when they filmed that, was just going to come out and do a few, like, very simple moves. And when Dick Van Dyke came out in the rehearsal and showed what he could still do and was giving ideas for, like, what could be done, like, Dick Van Dyke was still incredibly spry and able to do quite a few of the original moves still. And so it's really impressive.
Dick Van Dyke at time of this recording, 98 years old, definitely not as spry as he used to be, but he still has that, you can still see it in his eyes. He still has that heart.
Yeah. His mind at least is still with us. Mickey Rooney was a little less spry at the time they filmed this.
He would die less than 10 years after this movie came out.
Yeah. But they did a good job showing the differences between the men when they are away from the tablet and when they are under the influence of the tablet. So that's their main thing that they want, is to keep this tablet with them so that they can keep their virility, I guess.
They say that they've come accustomed to the nightlife. So yeah. You have these old men who, if having this tablet makes them young and spry, having a nightlife. I mean, Dick Van Dyke with, you know, Dick Van Dyke in the club at night. He'd do it too. But yeah, that's the main plot of the movie is you think that they picked him because he's special. He's going to be the special one, and turns out he's the patsy, and that's kind of the whole thing. Because a lot of things go wrong in the museum during these first few nights, and you think, oh, he doesn't know how to handle himself. It turns out that they're just purposely sabotaging things. There's a scene where after his first night, the three guards come to him and try to comfort him. And Bill Cobb's character kind of starts weeping. I mean, I have so many memories in this place. And it turns out he's just staggering behind to copy the key so they can have a spare key to get into the museum, so they can sabotage the night and start stealing from the museum. On one hand, yes, that's supposed to make them the bad guys, but in current climate 2024, being forced out of a job that they clearly still could do just because the museum doesn't want to pay them, I don't exactly blame them.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie without any real bad guys, except for maybe Ricky Gervais, who's kind of just a tool.
Your personal views on Ricky Gervais just as a person, notwithstanding, his character is kind of a D-bag in the movie. He's a tightwad. Trying to stay clean here. He's a tightwad. He's not a very jovial person, and seems to try to use metaphors to get his words across, but doesn't know what the metaphor is. I guess that's supposed to be funny.
Again, things that have the shape of jokes but do not land like jokes.
We mentioned that there's a Chris Columbus joke. One of the statues in the museum is one of Christopher Columbus, the explorer. And there's a running gag of Larry not remembering who he is. And that joke really only works if you remember that this is a 1492 production, which is Christopher Columbus's production company. And if you're a little kid, you're probably not going to get that joke. And the joke stopped being funny the first time they did it. They do it like four times.
I mean, the more we forget about the real Christopher Columbus, the original, the one that did all the genocides, probably the better.
Yeah. At least some of these exhibits know they're not the genuine article, like our Teddy Roosevelt, played by the legendary Robin Williams. He has all the memories of Teddy Roosevelt. He talks like Teddy Roosevelt, says quotes of Teddy Roosevelt, but is just saying, hey, I never did any of those things. Teddy Roosevelt did those things. I'm a wax figure that was made of Poughkeepsie. So yeah, speaking of, there is a subplot where the Teddy Roosevelt statue has a crush on the Sacagawea statue.
I mean, sure.
Beautiful actress that they got to play Sacagawea.
Yeah.
But, like, supposedly they have been, this Akam Ra exhibit has been in the museum for 50 years. So for 50 years, he's kind of been stalking this figure that is behind a glass and can't escape her exhibit. For 50 years, he never made an effort to go and talk to her in any way.
Sacagawea and the Lewis and Clark are in like a soundproof glass case, and I can't understand why.
Makes
it's
no sense.
Just there so the plot can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is that you really only get that in museums if there's something like really delicate or really valuable to protect. And as far as I can tell, these are just like wax figures there to portray the figures so that they can tell the story. You know, some of the other things are like they have taxidermied animals or whatever. You don't want to touch those, but they're not behind glass or, you know, whatever. Artifacts that you don't want to get stolen would be behind glass and everything. So why are these wax figurines, like, unless they were wearing actual, like, textiles, maybe? Like, the outfits were authentic? Or the props they were holding were the actual real objects from the expedition?
And it's just never explained in the movie.
Yeah. So it's like, why are these wax figurines behind this, like, soundproof glass? It doesn't make sense to me why they're there, except that you need to keep Teddy away from Sacagawea.
And Larry tries to talk to her, but she can't hear him because it's soundproof glass.
Yeah.
And another plot is our miniatures. We have three miniatures of one of Native Americans, one of the Roman Empire, and one of cowboys building a railroad. And one of those cowboys is played by Owen Wilson, who for some reason is uncredited in this movie. And the thing is, he has a pretty big role in the movie. So I'm wondering why he's uncredited. Usually uncredited goes to like cameos and stuff.
Yeah, that is the one that baffles me.
Maybe because he wasn't on set, because all the miniatures are either done on sound stages or green screen.
The weird thing is that he's not even... Because a lot of these special effects don't hold up. You can tell that Owen Wilson is not on set with the other people playing miniatures.
Mm.
The scene where they're trying to dynamite into the Roman exhibit at one point, and there's a bunch of Chinese railway workers and Owen Wilson. Owen Wilson is not in the same spot as the actors playing the Chinese railway workers. You can tell. Even though there's no reason for him to be green screened in because they're the same size. They're supposed to be in the same place on the same set at the same scale. But Owen Wilson is green screened into that scene. He is by himself on a green screen somewhere.
Maybe he had to be filmed separately for some reason.
That's my assumption, but I don't know what that reason was. And the same thing with him and Steve Coogan. There's a lot of times where you can tell that Owen Wilson and Steve Coogan, who have most of their scenes together, are not in the same place at the same time.
Not in the same shot.
Yeah. Even though it's a two shot.
Yeah.
Like, in any other circumstance, they would just be in the same place. But you can tell they're not. So it's very confusing.
And it's the very, you know, can they coexist tag team relationship, because he's the lead. Octavius is the leader of the Romans, and Jedediah is the leader of the railway workers, and they're each trying to break into each other's exhibits to expand, and it's like, okay, you two get together, you two work it out, because I'm not going to have you two causing problems every night trying to kill each other. And of course, it ends up with them being friends, because they have their little camaraderie moment when they're driving the toy car to lead the dinosaur to take out the three old security guards. Which is really weird. Like you said, they're in the same shot in the car, but they're clearly not in the same shot.
Yeah.
The funniest thing about it is that they're trying to, at the end of the movie, when they think that they're both dead, because you see the car crash, and they try to have them do a badass moment, and no matter what you do with Owen Wilson, you cannot make this man look badass.
Oh yeah, when they're doing the slow-mo walk back into the thing.
Yeah, like we lost some good men out there. No, we didn't. There they are.
What's so funny is Steve Coogan kind of looks badass, and Steve Coogan is not a badass.
Dressed as a Roman.
Yeah, I love Steve Coogan. He's a great actor and a great comedian. He is not a badass. But next to Owen Wilson, he looks like such a badass.
And Owen Wilson just has the Owen Wilson face. Oh, wow.
Yeah, that weirdly punchable face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If he was able to have a badass look, that scene would work, and it would be a nice bookend to the entire movie, where they straight up say the word impotent, because he's a figurine, his guns are toys, they don't fire, and he tries to act macho, but the minute that he's you know, he has his Gulliver travel moment with Larry, he's like, oh man, which is funny for Owen Wilson, but you know, it's like, okay, you want to have him his badass moment, and he's just has that Owen Wilson face.
Yeah. The thing is, though, is that let's talk about the kind of what happens, why they need the night guards, even though Ricky Gervais doesn't understand this. The night guards, you know, Dick Van Dyke says, don't let anything in or out. We find out that the reason why that is that if any of the exhibits are caught outside when the sun comes up and the sun hits them, they will turn to dust. And we only see this happen one time in the movie, when one of the Neanderthal statues goes outside to look at fire, and the sunlight hits him and he turns to dust, and a street sweeper sweeps him up.
The punchline to the joke.
But the thing is that it's not really,
it's supposed, I mean, it's treated as a very sad moment. Here he is, this Neanderthal, wants to see fire. He doesn't know that he's a statue, so he escapes. He goes out an open window. Who left the window open? We find out it's the other security guards. He sees the sun. The sun hits him. Just as Larry is getting out of the museum to drag him back in, he's too late. Sun hits him. He turns to dust, and it's supposed to be this very sad and somber moment, and then here comes a street sweeper as a sort of punchline.
But the thing is that What I hated most about it was that this is our understanding of what happens if things go catastrophically wrong, so that we know what happens at the end of the movie. Like, why we need to get everybody inside before the sun comes up. And we see this, and Ben Stiller's like, no, I've got to get to the guy. And he rushes out just in time to see the guy turn to dust. And then you see the street sweeper, and then Ben Stiller's like, well, that's that, and then turns in what's, like, this should be a moment of, like, oh my god, I didn't know that would happen.
But he's told this by Teddy Roosevelt. If any of us are outside of the museum when the sun comes up and the magic is gone, we turn to dust.
I missed that part then.
Hmm.
Because that was my first bit of, like, oh, okay, so that's why we don't go outside.
So, yeah, during the first night, Teddy Roosevelt gives Larry the tour, tells him about the magic, and tells him don't let any of us out, because if any of us are outside of the museum when the sun comes up, we turn to dust. And this is the setup of Aknamra as some sort of villain. Like, Aknamra is trying to get out of the sarcophagus every night. He's banging. And Teddy Roosevelt kind of teases him, hey, you've been trying to get out for 50 years, and you haven't got out before, and you're never going to get out of there now. Implying that Aknamra is villainous. Which, again, there's that... the punchline to that being... You know, the older security guards trap him in the exhibit. He has no choice but to open the sarcophagus, let Aknamra free, so they can get free. And he gets up and he starts, you know, like your typical old school mummy. This is only a few years, 2006 compared to 99 of the Brendan Fraser mummy movie. So people are going to think that movie with the mummy popping up, barking and yelling orders to his statues. And then he takes his bandages off, and it's just Rami Malek as the puppy guy. Like, oh man, it was so stuffy in there.
And I love the one thing that did kind of make me chuckle was when he said he went to Cambridge. And then he was like, well, you know, I was on display at Cambridge, so.
Yeah, because he starts speaking English. Like, where did you learn English? Oh, I went to Cambridge. When? Oh, I was in exhibit there for like 20 years. So they're able to escape because he said, you know, oh, no, now that I'm free, would you hand me my tablet so I can take my rightful place as ruler of this world? Yeah, there's a thing about that. Which leads us into our big grand finale chase scene where all of the exhibits are chasing after the guards to get the tablet back. Because if they don't get the tablet back, there goes the magic, and then they're all going to be statues and forever. No more coming to life at night, no more anything. And that leads us to the big chase scene. It's like, well, we have to get the tablet back, and now, and we have to get all the exhibits back into the museum before the sun comes up. So there's this is the culmination of another plot in the movie where Dick Van Dyke tells Ben Stiller, the best way to work here is to study on your history, because the more you know about these exhibits and their history, the better you can communicate with the exhibits. Which he does. There's a nice little running gag of him going to the library and going online and reading up on every single exhibit in the museum. And okay, I can get on Attila the Hun's good side. He likes magic. Okay, I'll learn a couple of close-up magic tricks and he'll be my friend, which kind of goes horribly wrong.
Well, he tried.
He tried. He tried. At least the thing is, he tried. And then he learns about the money horses, that the money horses will only stop if you say a specific word. He knows the word. He says the word, and then the horses stop, and that's how they get the tablet back. That's how they stop the older security guards. And Akhtam Ra uses the tablet to summon all of the exhibits that have escaped the museum to bring them back into the museum. But they've been seen. News cameras have seen the Neanderthal statues. There's dinosaur prints in the park. There's proof that these exhibits have been loose, and the tracks lead right back to the museum.
But, of course, everybody just thinks that this is a PR stunt.
A PR stunt that works, because one of the threads in the movie is that the museum has been on hard times. No one really goes to the museum anymore. That's why they're forcing the three older security guards to retire, because they can't afford to pay them anymore. Hence, they want to replace three with one young guy because he's cheaper to pay. But it works. The PR stunt works. The museum is more popular than it's ever been. And Ricky Gervais doesn't want to fire Ben Stiller anymore for all the mess he made. Oh, hey, your PR stunt worked. We're back in business. You get to keep your job. Yay. So we did skip over the Docent's side story. Rebecca is her name. And she's been writing this thesis on Sacagawea for years and years and years. And the problem is she keeps on hitting roadblock after roadblock, because a lot of things she wants to know about Sacagawea ends up was not documented. Like she says, if only there was a way I could ask Sacagawea in person about things, that I could finish my thesis. Because she's about to give up, because she's hit roadblock after roadblock. If only I could talk, if there was a way I could talk to her, I could find out the things that were not written down. And then he says, you know what, I can make that happen. He tells her the truth. Hey, at the end, every night the exhibits come to life. Why don't you talk to Sacagawea herself? And you can get all your answers. And of course, skeptic, oh yeah, the museum exhibits come to life through magic. Are you making fun of me? Are you, you know, laugh at the historian? Because every love interest thing kind of needs that misunderstanding moment.
I mean, does it need it?
No, but writers seem to think so, because we need to keep the plot moving. And it turns out she's in a cab when she sees the exhibits moving, and oh, he was telling the truth.
Also, can we point out is the late great Charlie Murphy as the cab driver there?
Mm.
Man, what a legend.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, at the end, she goes back to the museum. She sees the exhibits come to life. She has her conversation with Sacagawea to finish her thesis. Yay. And apparently that's kind of all she wanted, because she doesn't show up in any of the sequels.
Well, I mean, she probably never got that thesis published, because how do you cite that?
It's true.
I've been able to cite interviews with, you know, actual people before. Mm-hmm. How do you cite, I had a interview with a wax figure with the memories of Sacagawea?
Think you're crazy.
Yeah, that's not gonna, that, yeah, no academic source is gonna let that fly.
Eh. Like I said, I guess she got what she wanted. Like I said, she doesn't show up in any of the other movies. It could just be the actress didn't want to come back, but I'm trying to think of an in-universe reason here.
Yeah.
Also, the whole final act is Ben Stiller taking his son to the museum to show him the magic. So he's there, and he thinks his dad is the coolest guy in the world because the exhibits come to life.
I get to ride a T-Rex! Yay!
Yay. Yeah, that's Night at the Museum. It did... Okay, this movie did get a few sequels. We had, in 2009, we had the sequel, Battle of the Smithsonian. We had the third film in 2014, Secret of the Tomb. And most recently, 2022, we had an animated movie, Cartman Raw Rises Again, which had kind of no one from the original cast providing a voice for that animated movie. Yeah, I mean, Robin Williams had been gone for a while at that point. And obviously, Ben Stiller didn't want to do a cartoon.
And, you know, Rami Malek is, like, a star now.
Yeah. So, the Night at the Museum franchise, like I said, if you were a kid in the early 2000s when this came out, this was your childhood. I'm not going to drag on you for that. I mean, there's a lot of movies that we watched. There were a lot of kids movies that we watched in the 80s and 90s that when looking back as adults, just what were we thinking? But if this hit for you as a kid, if you come back to this movie with fond memories and nostalgia, I am not going to yuck your yum. But as a person in his 40s who was watching this for the first time all the way through, it wasn't terrible. I did not hate this movie. I could see what they were trying to do for this movie, but again, I was not a kid when this movie came out, so it wasn't. I am not the audience for this movie, nor have I ever been the audience for this movie. I've seen worse kids' movies. I've seen worse 2000s kids' movies. So this is like, it's okay. It's not great. It's not terrible. It's okay.
There was nothing in this for me. I mean, except for, you know, seeing some actors that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, they could have all been better used in better projects.
Mm.
It was nice seeing Robin Williams, though.
Yeah.
That's always nice.
So, does this movie have the magic? You know what? I'll say it does. It's fine. I'm not going to hate on it. But, Kiki?
No, not really.
Fair enough. Like I said, if you were a kid when this came out and you have nostalgia for it, great. But we were not, nor have ever been, the audience for this film. So, sure, whatever. Moving on to next week. Speaking of things that come to life when people aren't around, next week, Toy Story 3.
Yeah, time to go back to that franchise again.
Again? Didn't they announce Toy Story 5 happening or something? So it's going to be kind of interesting going back to Toy Story 3. Andy going to college. The toys get a new owner. The start of what people say is the downfall of the franchise. So it's going to be interesting going back to that. So come back next time for Toy Story 3, and we will talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye.
Don't let the magic stop here. Join our conversations on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Rewatching the Magic. We are on the X, formerly known as Twitter, at Rewatch the Magic, and new episodes are available every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.
Podcasts are fun,
but there's work to be done.
We encourage you to get involved. Here are some organizations we support.
The American Civil Liberties Union fights for the constitutional rights of all Americans. Find them at ACLU.org.
The National Network of Abortion Funds helps people find access to safe abortion services. Their site is abortionfunds.org.
The Trevor Project provides a 24/7 crisis helpline for LGBTQ youth and education services for schools on LGBTQ issues. They can be found at thetrevorproject.org.
Or find a way to help in your area.